This is our third presentation. We're going to go through some of Exodus and some of Numbers. Just a reminder that it would be nice if we could go verse by verse or chapter by chapter through the entire Bible, because there's so much here to mine and to dig out. But we can't do that. This is a survey class. There are some schools that actually will cover entire, spend one semester on the Old Testament and spend another semester on the New Testament, but we don't do that here at Palomar. We are covering the entire Bible, so there is a lot of skipping and selecting going on. So let's start with the background. We've got the children of Israel who have actually gone, most of them have gone to Egypt because of famine. And we pick up there, they're in the land where they really don't belong. And of course we get that ominous opening to the book of Exodus in the first chapter. Verse 8 says, "Then a new king who did not know about Joseph came to power in Egypt." Well, that's not a good sign. Actually, some of the historical records suggest that during this time in Egypt there was an uprising, a time of trouble and chaos when some foreign groups came in and took over, and so Egypt was in an uproar. So they have looked out and noticed that the children of Israel are there and are foreigners as well, and the Egyptians are very hostile to these foreigners. And so Moses comes along at the time to give these people some hope and a way to escape their bondage at this time. And I'd like you to consider something. We're not going to take the time to follow up on all of the life of Moses, but some people have suggested that Moses, in his life, follows the trajectory, I guess we would say, of many other heroes from olden days. Often, for example, these heroes are threatened at birth. Think about how many stories you've read from the past of heroes who are threatened at their birth. They usually are hidden as a way to escape the dangers when they're young. They have some time of initiation or insight as they are older and find out what their real purpose is all about. They often withdraw from the rest of the human race to consider their purpose and their mission. They are given some kind of special powers. They appear to be reluctant heroes, oftentimes not running to the forefront, but staying behind. They often have some sort of weakness that may bring them down later on. So we won't do that. We won't go through the whole story of Moses, but as you do that, look for those things, the birth, the way he avoided being killed when he was young, the time of insight in his life, the withdrawal. You'll know that story of where he flees to Midian. Look for the inspiration. In fact, we're going to take a look at that today, a moment of inspiration with the burning bush. Look for the powers that he gets. Look for his reluctance to use these powers. He really drags his feet when he goes before Pharaoh and later on. And look for the weaknesses that he will display. So why don't we take a look at the episode in chapter 3 of Exodus. Very famous, the one story with the burning bush here. And I wanted to look especially at this part because we get the names of God that the Jews will use. So let's take a second here in chapter 3, verse... let's pick up on 13. So Moses encounters this burning bush. He's puzzled by it, and of course God is speaking to him out of this bush. He says to God, "Suppose I go to the Israelites and say to them, 'The God of your fathers has sent me to you,' and they ask me, 'What is his name?' Then what shall I tell them?" Well, and then verse 14 is an interesting verse that people have puzzled over for some time. God said to Moses, "I am who I am." And my Bible has a footnote. It may be translated, "I will be what I will be." So he's supposed to say to the Israelites, "I am has sent me to you." Now it strikes me, and probably has struck you, as an odd name for God. We might think of other names. God could have said, when Moses said, so who are you? You know, what's your name? Because names are a big deal, aren't they, in ancient societies? They reveal something about the person. Think about how many Bible names have had special meaning. And you think about the kinds of things God could say. His name could be the one who delivers, the one who thunders from on high, the one who creates, the one who is in command, the one who destroys, whatever it is. But instead, I am who I am, or I will be what I will be. I'll let you think about that and see what you come up with. My feeling is that I am who I am. God is self-existent, doesn't depend on anybody else. He is who he is. He's not in any kind of subservience to anything or anyone. Total independence. None of us can say that about ourselves. Or I will be what I will be. He has determined it all. It's not up to us. It strikes me a little bit of the answer that Job gets. We'll get to the book of Job later on. And when Job finally encounters God, he learns something about God that he probably wasn't really expecting. So I want to take just a second here. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but as far as the names of God or the way God is mentioned in the Bible, you'll see in some places in your Bible, at least it's the way that the NIV treats it, L-O-R-D, capitalized, and I see it all through this section here. For example, it's in verse 15. God says to Moses, say to the Israelites, the Lord, the God of your fathers, has sent me to you. L-O-R-D, it's all caps. Verse 16, go assemble the elders of Israel and say to them, the Lord, L-O-R-D, capitalized. So it's all through here. And when you see that in your Bible, L-O-R-D is that mystical four-letter combination, Y-H-W-H. We don't even know how to pronounce it, and the Jews did not pronounce it because of respect for God. It just was those four letters called a tetragrammaton. And we think it's probably pronounced Yahweh, Y-H-W-H. So if you ever see that in your Bible, L-O-R-D capitalized, they didn't say Lord. That was their most special name for God, Yahweh. Now, you see also in verse 15, it says, God said to Moses, G-O-D, small o, small d. That's the Hebrew word Elohim, which, interesting, is a plural, isn't it? H-I-M or I-M on the end of words, like cherubim and Elohim. That's a plural name. So Christians are going to take that as a thought that maybe this is a suggestion of the Trinity. Those who are not Christians may say this is God being in the plurality of his magnificence. It's like, you know, there's an abundance to this God. You may see a third way of describing God in the Bible. Let me see if I can find that for you here. I don't know that it's in this section, but if you ever see Lord, L-O-R-D, but not capital L-O-R-D, just small o, small r, small d. I don't see it in these chapters here. But if you see that, that's the word Adonai. So there are a lot of different ways that the Hebrews could talk about their God. So you may see Lord that way, you may see capital L-O-R-D, that's the Yahweh word. And I've got some information on that term Yahweh in your booklet. You can look at that sometime. So there are the first few chapters of Exodus where Moses has received insight into God and he's found out what he needs to do. He's going to go on this mission, and of course we know what that mission entails. He goes to Pharaoh, says, let my people go. Pharaoh says no, and he uses them for slaves, and Moses says, all right, plagues are coming on your house. So here are the special powers that the hero has, and he brings on these plagues. And of course, people again have puzzled over that for a long time. Are these supernatural events? Well, that's possible. Are they natural events? That's possible as well. And I've got that covered in the booklet you can look at sometime. Some people see it as a sequence of events that may take, actually, if they are natural events, could have taken up to a year as far as possibly some anthrax or some natural plague that affected the frogs and it was passed along to higher animals and so on. Others looking at the plague say that these all represent attacks on Egyptian deities. You know, for example, the darkness, the sun god was being attacked there. So you can check that out sometime if you want. I wanted to take you to one of the plagues because, again, I want you to use your imagination. We've said this before, but it's important that you use your imagination and to get the most out of the Bible. And then I always encounter people that say the Bible is grim reading, it's not interesting, it's not funny, there's nothing lighthearted. Well, here in the middle of these plagues, there's something that struck me as funny, and maybe it did you as well. So I'm in chapter 8 of Exodus, and we've had frogs. Look in verse 6. Frogs came up and covered the land. So in verse 8, Pharaoh begs Moses, pray to the Lord, there's L-O-R-D, that's Yahweh, to take the frogs away. I'll let your people go. And Moses says, fine, to the Pharaoh, I'll leave it to you. You set the time. In other words, when do you want these to go away? Now, if it's you or if it's a friend of yours and a person comes and you're just decimated with these plagues and says to you, tell us when you want these plagues to leave, wouldn't you say, right now, let's get rid of them? Because, I mean, imagine Pharaoh. He's got, you know, frogs are hopping around all over the place. They're in his food. They're in his closets. They're in his bed. They're in his clothes. They're just covering the land. But what does Pharaoh say? Verse 10, tomorrow. Now, isn't that interesting? That's all it says, just that one word. But I think it speaks a lot about Pharaoh. What do you think? Why would a person who really doesn't want this plague to last another 5 seconds, why would he say tomorrow? My thought on that is that Pharaoh is trying to save face. He's trying to act like, you know, it's not that big a deal. Yeah, I'd like you to get rid of him, Moses, but hey, take your time. Tomorrow's good enough. So here they are, frogs hopping all over the place, and Pharaoh is flicking them out of his bedclothes, saying, yeah, tomorrow will be fine. So that strikes me as funny, and maybe it did you as well. I wanted to pause here before we go on to another chapter to consider something, and that is we have these stories of the Jews inside Israel, Jews inside Egypt. And, of course, the question would be, well, do we have any evidence for them being in Egypt? And I mentioned that there were a lot of upheavals, there were a lot of major social migrations taking place during this time period. And actually, there are several things that we do know, that there were definitely Israelite slaves in the land of Goshen, which is, you can look at it on their map, but upper Egypt there, upper to the north, I should say. Before 1446 BC, that's before the date of the Exodus, at least the rough date that most people think of. But there's proof that Israel apparently arrived in the land of Canaan around 1400 BC. And there's evidence that Israel wandered from Egypt to Canaan about the time of the Exodus. So there's several of these things. Let's take, for example, evidence of Israel actually being in Egypt before 1400 BC. Researchers have noted the style of architecture, the kinds of statues found, the tombs, the pottery, wall paintings. Artifacts have all suggested people from Canaan were in Egypt during that time. There are actually Egyptian household records that list slave names that include Hebrew names. People have apparently discovered public works buildings. There were projects built by Semites. They have wall murals depicting Semitic slaves working away. They have wall inscriptions they found in Semitic languages and referring to what they called Asiatic people. Well, to the Egyptians, Asiatic was anybody east of Egypt. And these people didn't worship the Egyptian god Ra. What about evidence of Israel coming into the land around 1400 BC? Well, there's something called the Amarna letters. And they refer to the conquest of Canaan by a group of people called the Habiru, H-A-B-I-R-U. And it may be an actual reference to the Hebrew people. And what they found when they look at the recordings of nations and city-states being conquered, it matches the biblical record. Then they have something called the Marimta Stele, which is a stone that records an attack made by a pharaoh into Canaan in 1209 BC. And it mentions Israel. and implies that it was actually a dominant group in the area. Well, that's interesting. So it lets you know that by 1209 BC, Israel was actually established and becoming dominant by then. Another Egyptian monument from around 1400 BC describes, this is a direct quote, nomads of Yahweh in the area mentioned in the Bible during their years of wandering. There's even an Egyptian document, part of a poem called the Pur Papyrus, and describes events that sound like the 10 plagues mentioned in Exodus. So we can put a lot of these together, and amazingly, there's more information than I was aware of. I came across this a while back, and I thought that was interesting. I wanted to share with you. Well, let's pick up now in Exodus 11 and 12. We get this plague, we get the Passover, and of course, Christians are going to connect the Passover event, the fact that an animal was slaughtered and blood was applied and it saved the people. They're going to see that, of course, as referring to Jesus. The Passover has become a huge tradition for the Jews. I've got some information online so you can see what it meant to go through the Passover meal and what that's like for the Jewish culture. I'd like to go to the second half of chapter 12. There's a reference here that causes a lot of people to scratch their heads. I'm in chapter 12, verse 37. So it says they are on their way, they're journeying. And it says there are about 600,000 men on foot, besides women and children. So you figure, you know, another 600,000 women and maybe another 600,000 children or something like that. We're pushing to 2 million people. And there are a lot of individuals today who are highly skeptical of that number. I mean, what would that be like to have 2 million people marching around out in the desert? Actually, in the book of Numbers later on, in chapters 1 and 2, it also indicates a similar count. Well, it doesn't seem possible, does it? At least for some people. Others have looked at the way the numbers are written, and of course, it's very different for ancient peoples. And when they say, for example, in Numbers, that there were 45,000 people in one tribe or one group, it may mean 45 families or groups or 45 tenths of people, T-E-N-T-S, tenths of people, that may be a way of thinking about it. And if that was the case, you'd end up with a total number of Israelites around 20,000, which seems far more reasonable, doesn't it? Another way of looking at it, I came across a while back, I thought it was interesting. Remember how important genealogy is to the Jewish people. Everybody needs to know who their ancestors are. Who are you, the son of? Who's your mother? What's her family background? What's your father's family background? So some people suggest that that number was a symbolic number representing the dead as well as the living. So remember Joseph said at the end of Genesis, after I die and you leave this land, take me with you. So it's possible that, in a sense, all those who died in Egypt are leaving, in a spiritual sense, leaving the land with the living, which could give you the hundreds of thousands then. It's interesting, if you jump ahead to Joshua 4:13, this is another quick reference to the numbers of people as they are crossing the Jordan River. There, it's something like 40,000. And then if you look at Numbers 3, verses 40 to 43, there's a census of the firstborn there, around 22,000. So you can see other places that suggest the numbers may be far smaller than we initially might think of. Well, they're on their march, they're on their way, they cross the sea, they're delivered from their enemy as the army of Pharaoh is washed away. And again, the puzzle is, where did this all take place? Where is Mount Sinai when he's going to get the Ten Commandments? Well, there's a traditional place, and you can look it up on your map, but a lot of people suggest this doesn't really fit the entire story. It may not be the Red Sea itself where the crossing took place. It may be over further east to what's called the Gulf of Aqaba. And you can take a look at that on a map sometime. Go online. There's a big debate about this. There are groups that will argue the location, so you can check that out sometime. I'd like to pick up in chapter 19. This is Moses at Mount Sinai. This is another covenant. Remember, we've discussed already the Abrahamic covenant. There is the Noah covenant. And now here comes another covenant. God and Moses go discuss things on Mount Sinai. Excuse me, in verse 5 of chapter 19. Here's what God says. Now, if, and I want to highlight that if, and I'll come back to that in a second. Now, if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all nations you will be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. So Moses carries these words back to the people and says, what do you think? Are you in? And verse 8, the people all respond, we will do everything the Lord has said. Now, this is a different kind of covenant, isn't it, than the one for Noah? Basically, Noah didn't have to do anything. The human race did not have to do anything. God just simply said, here's what I will do for you. I will not destroy the earth again. And here's the sign, and they mentioned the rainbow. This is different, though, isn't it? This is a two-way covenant. How do we know that? Verse 5, if you obey me. So the Hebrews have to do something, and if they do that, then they will be blessed. If they don't do that, there will be consequences. And all through the rest of the Old Testament, the prophets are going to remind the people, you made a bargain with God. You signed a contract with God. And you have not lived up to it. And we're going to get this litany of problems that they have created, things they've done wrong. Again and again, they're going to be lashed by these prophets. The prophets are going to say, you broke this commandment, or this covenant. You broke this agreement, this bargain, this contract with God. That's a holy contract. You broke it. You're going to suffer big time. And so they promised all sorts of negative things coming as a result. Well, the book of Exodus is a powerful book. It's influenced so many people over the years since then. For example, the American Revolution, the Mormons, African Americans, their leader Martin Luther King, who came along in the 50s and 60s, Leon Uris, who wrote a book about this, thinking about the Jews in a new Exodus after World War II. So this book has provided tremendous inspiration, powerful things coming out of this. Can we turn over to Numbers? We're not going to read a lot of Numbers. Again, it's just a time problem. But in chapter 13 of Numbers, the people have struggled through the wilderness for all these years, and they finally have come up to the land of Canaan, which is theirs. That's the land that's been promised them. But of course, it's full of other groups of people now since they left and have gone down to Egypt. So they're coming back to a strange land that they're not comfortable with. And this land has been taken over by some seriously powerful people. So for 40 days, a group went out and explored from the different tribes, took a look. And a lot of them were very hesitant to go. And only two of the spies or the scouts came back, Joshua and Caleb, and said, we can do this. And I'll tell you what I wanted to look at here. It's just a small thing, but again, I was just impressed, and I thought it was interesting to look at. Toward the end of chapter 13, we hear one of the ones coming back saying, this is something we can accomplish. And this is Caleb, verse 30 of chapter 13. Caleb says, we should go up and take possession of the land, for we can certainly do it. And the others say, oh no, these are strong, these are tough people. Well, I want you to keep that in mind, Caleb. Now, here he is. He's young. He's part of this advanced scouting group that went out and took a look at the land. Now, Caleb comes into the Bible later on. So I want to turn over to Joshua. Joshua 14. They've fought. They've come into the land. Years and years have gone by. We find out at the beginning of chapter 13, Joshua is old. He's in charge, and they're dividing the land up, and in some places they've been successful, other places not very successful. They are being allotted different territories, and when the land is divided, of course, many people want the easy stuff. They want the best land with the fewest enemies in it, but we encounter Caleb one more time. Now I'm in chapter 14, and this is verse 6. Excuse me. So the men of Judah come up, and here's what Caleb says. I was 40 years old. I'm in verse 7 now. I was 40 years old when Moses, the servant of the Lord, sent me from Kadesh Barnea to explore the land, and I brought him back a report according to my convictions. But my brothers who went with me made the hearts of the people melt with fear. Remember, they had said, oh no, this is a scary bunch of people that are there. I, however, followed the Lord, my God, wholeheartedly. So on that day, Moses swore to me, the land in which your feet have walked will be your inheritance and that of your children forever, because you have followed the Lord, my God, wholeheartedly. Now then, just as the Lord promised, he's kept me alive for 45 years since the time he said this to Moses. So 45 years, think about that. Let's assume he's young as a scout, maybe 25. Actually, we get the years that he is here. So it says, I was alive for 45 years since the time he said this to Moses while Israel moved about in the desert. So here I am today, 85 years old. So we do learn his age. I'm still as strong today as the day Moses sent me out. I'm just as vigorous to go out to battle now as I was then. Now give me this hill country that the Lord promised me that day. You yourself heard then that the Anakites were there. Okay, this is a scary group of people. And their cities were large and fortified. But the Lord helping me, I'll drive them out just as he said. I don't know about you, but have you ever been around somebody who's old, but extremely proud of either physique or looks or intelligence, because, you know, God has blessed them in a way that they still can do those things that they used to do when they were younger? They haven't lost a step, and they're the first ones to tell you that. I haven't lost a step. And so here's Caleb, in a sense, boasting. But he just comes across as an interesting old guy. He says, yeah, give me that land up there on the hill where there's large fortified enemy cities. I'll take it. So this guy, 85 years old, when he should be sitting around enjoying life, playing with grandchildren and just letting things go past him, he's right at the forefront. So I got to believe it'd be scary to be an Anakite to see this 85-year-old guy swinging a spear or club or whatever he had heading up the hills. So we'll stop at this point. We've done some of Exodus, some of Numbers. The people are getting ready to come into their land, and we'll cover that next time when we spend a little more time in the book of Joshua, and we'll look at Judges once they're in the land and see what happens to them there.